San Francisco, a radio.com sports station.
Known Kyle Bonagura for a long time, and chances are in the Bay Area you have too. He is now with ESPN.com, and he was part of a large writing team which put together a comprehensive piece on how sports league by league might go about returning. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us today. Damon and Ratto with you this afternoon. How are you doing, pal?
I'm doing all right, Damon. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, good to have you here. Which league were you concentrating on for this .com piece?
So I stuck with college football. That's my role at ESPN.com, is basically on the West Coast college football beat. So my contributions came in that section of the article, but was certainly part of the discussions with our larger group about how to approach this as a topic and combine our resources to kind of understand what medical professionals are being leaned on and how each individual league is kind of processing their pathway back to the resumption of play.
Kyle, as you examine the restart of college football, how much did you think that there was going to be like, hey, Division I consensus will be the way we all come back? And then how much do you now realize that it's going to be league by league, campus by campus, school by school, almost coach by coach?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the second part for sure. And I think what's interesting about college football versus the other professional leagues is there's a lot of just major structural differences, right? I mean, there are, programs in 49 states that play college football, and these are institutions that are under government umbrellas who have to, look for guidance from, chancellors and presidents and state and local government to make these decisions, right, which is significantly more complicated than the already complicated process ahead for the professional sports, which are dealing with, professional athletes making millions of dollars. And there's a lot of considerations that you have to take into account for college football to resume. That being said, I do think here we are today and, May, whatever date it is, that everyone's working towards an on-time start for college football. I don't necessarily know that that's a done deal. There's obviously a lot of time between now and when the start of the season will be, but it's been a kind of a fascinating few weeks to see how these leagues and conferences have kind of worked together to try to figure out what makes the most sense for the sport as a whole.
Do you get the sense that the SEC basically saying everybody else is on their own, this is what we're doing, is the first sign that maybe the Power Five conferences are about to fracture a little bit? Because the way things were framed a few weeks ago was that nobody was going to get out in front of anybody else in terms of practices, in terms of isolated workouts, in terms of scheduling, in terms of anything. And then when Greg Sankey, the commissioner of the SEC, said, no, we're going to open when we want to open, was that an indication that the Power Five may not be able to be kept together?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could certainly allow that as a possibility. That being said, that all the athletic directors in the Pac-12 that I talked with, including the commissioner of the conference, Larry Scott, none of them were ever never really thought that that was a possibility, that the SEC was going to move forward without the other Power Five conferences being a part. Maybe some of the timeline would be a little bit different. The SEC announced today that it's going to allow its student athletes to return to campus on a voluntary basis at the start of June or in the first week of June. The Pac-12 is going to vote on that same issue next week with a similar time frame in mind. And so I think what's important to keep in mind with the colleges is that as much public posturing that goes on, right? Regionality is such a big part of college football, as you guys both know. And I think it was a lot easier for the leaders of these SEC schools to go out in public and make those kind of declarations, while the people on the West Coast were a little bit more hesitant to kind of make those same statements in a public forum, just because of the bite back for something like that would be received differently, and they would set them up for a little bit of a different response. And so that just kind of, we're talking about the complications involved. I think that kind of the regionality is really, important thing to keep in mind there.
Kyle Bonagura here on 95.7 The Game. Sticking with the theme of regionality, we got two Pac-12 teams here in this region, Cal and Stanford, that operate under very, very different financial parameters, public school, private school. How much difference does a public school have to go through to start playing as opposed to a private school? because of California's standards?
Yeah, it's going to be what they have to do will be very different, right? Because the UC system will basically be making all these determinations. And but at the same time, I have a hard time believing that they will end up operating differently. I think that Cal and Stanford will likely be united in whatever approach they move forward with. Generally speaking, there's going to be some subtle change, subtle differences campus to campus all over the country. But I do believe, based on talks with people at both schools, that they would like to work in concert to ensure that there isn't any, from a competitive aspect too, is a consideration as well. They want everyone coming back at the same time. They don't want any competitive disadvantages. But Stanford does have an easier path forward just because it doesn't have to play by the UC system rules and ultimately answer to people in elected offices, right? Stanford is going to do what Stanford wants, and there'll be some local considerations that needs to take into account. But at the same time, they're much more free to operate however they'd like.
Are there any schools in either the Pac-12 or the Mountain West that are in such financial straits that playing in front of empty stadiums would cause them a level of financial distress that might call into question whether they could survive? Or are they all able to endure 1 year of hardship?
That's a good question. I think the financial hit that all of these teams would take without college football can't be understated. It represents, anywhere between 75% to 90% of the revenue. Football alone represents anywhere from 75% to 90%, generally speaking, for the revenue that these programs bring in. So if you cut out that portion of the pie, the repercussions at this point almost are, it's not worth thinking about because it would be so devastating. You would see the non-revenue generating sports would disappear pretty quickly. You're already seeing that even without a canceled football season. To get to kind of the root of that question, the athletic directors really don't even want to consider that as an option at this point because it's such a doomsday scenario to consider that there is no good solution. I mean, there's no good solutions right now, right? They're all varying degrees of bad solutions to move forward with sports, not just in college, but in professional sports as well. And so they're considering the bad solutions first and then the almost inconceivable idea that they would lose almost all their revenue for a calendar year is kind of tough to contemplate. But at the same time, I certainly think it's on the table because as much as we all believe here in May that college football's coming back in some form or fashion, it's still not a guarantee.
Boise State was among the first to basically furlough their entire football program. Are they close to resuming? Are they agitating to resume? Because Boise State might be the only Mountain West school that generates enough money that it can sustain.
So my understanding on Boise State is that the furloughs for the football staff was because the staff members made over X amount of dollars. I don't know what the cutoff was, but all university employees, including members of the athletic department making over like $50,000, had to take a 1 week furlough. So that's my understanding of what was happening at Boise State, and I don't think that they'll be in a position where they wouldn't be able to move forward playing football should the Mountain West resume under some sort of a normal schedule, right? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just was wondering where they were at because they were for a successful program financially, they were awfully quick to shut stuff down. And I think it sort of sent shockwaves through a lot of other, for lack of a better word, mid-majors or quality group of five teams that it was just, wait a minute, Boise State's really successful and they're already putting padlocks up.
Right. I mean, just the fact that decision came from, I don't know who ultimately made that call, but I do believe that most of those coaches, if not all of them, are off the furlough and back to some sort of, whatever the new normal is right now. So I wouldn't be concerned about Boise State specifically compared to other Mountain West programs. If anything, they're in a better position to resume play because, their region, here today in May hasn't been hit as hard, and the revenue that they've generated does, provide them a little bit more stability than, a program at San Jose State or Nevada where the revenue is completely different.
Kyle Bonagura here on 95.7 The Game. You can catch him out again with about 15 other people on ESPN.com breaking down how everybody comes back. I was going to ask you as a clever final question, which sport has it easier? Which sport has it the hardest? But the answer is it's hard for everyone. No one's got it easy. Nobody. Kyle, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today. Have yourself a good weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much. Kyle Bonagura. And we are brought to you by DuckDuckGo Privacy. You want the same internet, but more privacy? DuckDuckGo's got you covered. They help millions of people like you get privacy online without any trade-offs. With one download, you can search and browse privately, avoiding trackers, and it's all for free. DuckDuckGo Privacy Simplified. 888-957-9570. When we come on back, some great sound from Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott, Bob Costas, who joined Ray and I earlier this week. And, man, you know, baseball would think that, like, it was one person. Like, Mr. or Mrs. Baseball wasn't making an awful lot of money this year. That, my friends, is not the truth. We're going to come on back and talk about how a big number whacked up 30 ways really should be a lot more digestible than they claim it is. Don't you go anywhere. Damon Ratto and Kolsky. No Kolsky this afternoon, but we're here for you. Me and Ray Sunshine Ratto on 95.7 The Game.
Damon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
Larry Scott, Pac-12 commissioner, joined our morning show today. Bob Costas joined us earlier in the week talking a little Major League Baseball. We're going to hear from him in just a little bit. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, no Kolsky this afternoon. It's just Ray and I with the boys back in the studio. And speaking of the boys are back, one of the boys used to be drafted and played for the 49ers is back in the NFC West. Carlos Hyde has just signed a one-year deal with the Seattle Seahawks. How about that? Carlos Hyde, obviously, after leaving the 49ers after the 2017 season, had a two-team disappointment in 2018 where it never really clicked in Cleveland nor in Jacksonville. 2019, he goes over 1,000 yards for the first time in his career and had six touchdowns, two off his career high, with the Houston Texans. So Carlos Hyde, now a Seattle Seahawk. Will that strike fear into the NFC West? I always thought of him as a little of a, never quite delivered on the promise. You know, I think Carlos Hyde is a good player. He's not a game changer.
But he gives Seattle at least some stability in the backfield, which it hadn't had at all last year and not even very much the year before. Losing Marshawn Lynch was a blow that they never really overcame to the point where they had to bring him back. So, no, Carlos Hyde is a perfectly serviceable running back if you provide him a level of blocking and holes to run through that allows him to be good. I mean, when he was with the 49ers, those things didn't really exist. So I tend not to grade him quite so harshly because if you can't open up a hole – a running back is useless to you.
Yeah, I mean, he has not been in a very good situation, really, until last year. And that Houston situation, I don't think was universally agreed on as a good situation, but they were a playoff team. And Carlos Hyde, again, had 1,000 yards last year in Houston. Next year, this upcoming season, he'll be carrying for Pete Carroll and the Seattle Seahawks. So Carlos Hyde coming back to Levi's Stadium. Will you be coming back to Levi's Stadium? I guess that's a question the NFL will be asking itself at some point. You will ask yourself that question when the time feels right for you to come on back. Larry Scott today was on with our morning show, Joe Lo and Dibs, who might be the smartest show on the radio because I believe all three hosts took the day off leaving the morning show today, to JD and Jim Cozumel, who were talking with Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott, and Scott said the plan is indeed to start on time.
All the conferences together, all the major conferences together, are going to have to be involved in the decision about the college football season. And right now, our plan is that we're going to be starting on time, and we're going to play a full season, non-conference, conference, bowl games in the college football playoff, and there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic that we're on a nice glide path for that to happen, but it certainly means that public health officials will have to continue to be confident that that can happen and our medical experts are comfortable and all the conferences can align around that decision. What we also have to agree on nationally, and we pretty much have in principle, is for a six-week training camp leading up to the start of the season, which means sometime in late July, official team practices could start. And so those are all decisions that are going to get made nationally together, in my opinion, and we as a conference will act together on that.
Larry Scott, Pac-12 commissioner. And look, I've never been a big fan, Ray, and I got to tell you, I think that his opening opinion here, the first soundbite we've played, I think he's totally off. I think he is completely fooling himself if he thinks that it's going to be lockstep every conference together going to restart when they agree upon it's the safe time to do it. The only we're going to do it all together is if you're going to join the SEC, because the SEC is going to do it whether or not you goddamn well plan on it, yes or no, or a doctor said it's good for you, bad for you, doesn't matter. Like, they're not going to care. So you have to not care too, if not caring is going to be how this decision is made. Like, him saying it's going to be a nationwide consensus, I don't believe that at all, and I don't think you do either. The SEC would gladly play if four other major conferences weren't playing, much less the Pac-12, which the SEC, I think, looks right down its nose at.
Well, I think he doesn't believe it either. He has to say it for reasons of politics, but his situation is different in that the Pac-12 is run by its presidents, not by its commissioner, or even its athletic directors. And the presidents will probably be learier of starting than any of the SEC presidents or athletic directors, or even Greg Sankey, the commissioner, because the SEC is largely 14 independent kingdoms held together by a gigantic paycheck at the end. The SEC network is a huge moneymaker, so they're going to gravitate to that. The SEC championship game is a huge moneymaker. They're going to gravitate to that. But in all other areas, they all sort of accept the fact that everybody's on his own. And the Pac-12 doesn't do that. Larry Scott knows that, but he can't really say that. So I'm not surprised at what he said, and I also don't think he believes a word of it.
Well, if you're telling me that, you know, the words just, you know, it's all lip service. It's a time where I think lip service actually moves you in the wrong direction. Like, let's talk about this openly and honestly. Let's hopefully do that. And I don't want to unplug the validity of the rest of these sound bites here. But look, you might be right. Maybe he is just telling you what he knows he needs to say, and he doesn't believe. How about this? Ray, I hope you're right, because I think he's dead wrong. And I don't know how much trouble he would be in to just say, look, man, we're going to use science. If other people want to use their guts, so be it. Or maybe he really doesn't want to use science. I mean, that's it. Why do we think that just because, you know, oh, well, Pac-12, you think West Coast, you think left, you think liberal, that we're going to... The Pac-12 has a heroin addiction for money that, you know, they want to scratch that itch as much as anybody, probably more than some conferences who do have robust television networks that are filling the coffers in ways that ADs never assumed would be possible. Every single check that a Pac-12 school's gotten from its network's been disappointing.
Yeah, but the politics of the Pac-12 are different than everybody else's. The Big 12 is philosophically aligned with the SEC. The Big 10 is philosophically aligned with the SEC, although they tend to vote in a block more than the SEC does. But football wags the is the tail that wags the dog there. The ACC, you know, between basketball and football, basketball probably has more power. But football, they've got Clemson, and Clemson matters. Clemson has throw weight. The Pac-12 is the one conference of those five for whom the league doesn't run the schools. The schools run the league. And for good or ill, that's been the way it's been forever. Are there presidents who are unhappy with with the way the conference has operated, especially in terms of the TV contracts? Yeah, but they have not bothered to band together yet and force an issue. They've sort of let the conference run itself, and Larry Scott knows that as soon as he gets that over his skis, there will be enough presidents ready to pounce, and they'll pounce on him. So he's being careful, and he's saying the things that he believes the presidents want to hear, but I think he knows what the reality is, and the reality is the SEC and the other four Power Five conferences are going to operate as though the athletic department runs the library, not the other way around.
Larry Scott, on our morning show today on 95.7 The Game, talked about the conditions which will be implemented so students can return to campus.
So we've had a lot of discussion. Yeah, I'd say it's preliminary in our league, but multiple discussions with our presidents and chancellors. And I think philosophically, we believe that it has to be safe enough for campus to be open and to have some students back on campus in order for us to feel comfortable having student athletes back on campus. At the moment, all of our schools are working toward that, intending that, understanding that, you know, the new normal will be different from the old normal. Every school is thinking about hybrid models where they're allowing for social distancing and, of course, intense hygiene and protocols in place, you know, because no one's anticipating a vaccine. So protocols for when students, faculty, others have the virus, what you do about that. But all of our schools at the moment are intending to be open in some capacity and have some cohort of students back on campus. So that's what we're working toward. And if things keep progressing in a positive way, I'm pretty optimistic about it.
Ray, they got their talking points down. You heard him say hybrid. That's the exact same thing that John Wilner was writing about in regards to Berkeley the other day, bringing back students in a hybrid fashion, the vast, vast, vast majority online. But if we can't have practice without kids on campus, what hybrid are we willing to agree to get whatever the required number of feet on campus property is to say, okay, campus is open? And that's really what's going on here.
Unless the presidents are willing to look the other way, and there's still not any indication that they are, I don't know that the Pac-12 can start with a hybrid situation, because they don't feel like it. Now, they may change their mind in a month because everything about this is different than it was a month ago. But the SEC has been pretty firm all along that, oh, no, we're a football conference. We do football. And so it's no surprise that they're pursuing the line that they're pursuing. It's no surprise that the Big Ten and the ACC will follow shortly. It's a different view of what athletics is on the West Coast. And when it becomes such a strained money situation in the Pac-12, they'll change their mind too. I mean, but they've got to say what they say now, because there aren't any presidents ready to hear what the SEC is putting out yet.
What could really strain the campuses in terms of, are you making money with football happening in an empty stadium? Are fans? Hey, Larry Scott, what do you expect for fans in stadiums?
My expectation, if things keep on the glide path that they're on, is that, you know, we'll have a college football season, which will be a big boost to society in America and to these, you know, young people who are working hard toward it. But it'll be a real mixed bag within our conference and perhaps around the country in terms of whether fans in the stadium or not. I would expect at the moment, based on the guidance I've seen from different states, that we will have some states where there are no fans at first. We'll have some states where there will be limited numbers of fans allowed and a gradual phase-in approach to allowing more and more fans during the season as things progress.
He went on to say, hey, some of these schools, they're going to be letting them in probably in ways that make you think, well, how come we're not selling out?
In talking to my colleagues across the country, which I do every single day, there are some parts of the country, not on the West Coast, but some parts of the country where we'll have full stadium, that I don't think there'll be public policy that prevents it. And the mindset of the fans there will be they want to attend the college football game on a Saturday and won't have the same concern. So I think it's going to be a very interesting social experiment and public policy experiment to see when the NFL starts and when college football starts, you know, what the different markets look like in terms of fan attendance.
Let me tell you about the market of Columbus, Ohio. Don't get confused and think, well, you know, that's the state capital of Ohio. They must be. No. The number one generator of revenue, interest, tourism, it's the Ohio State Buckeyes. It's the number one industry in Columbus, Ohio. It's not even government. It's Buckeye football. Ohio State, according to Nate Scott, USA Today, Ohio State is floating the idea that the horseshoe is big enough to safely accommodate 20,000 safely. And I bring up Nate Scott because he wrote the following paragraph. Again, I have no idea if it's safe or not to put a bunch of people in a stadium, but citing these models and suggesting that it would be safe to put 20,000 people in a stadium because they'd all adhere to socially distant guidelines is at best naive and at worst misleading. It isn't how people act. We don't exist in magical bubbles, and Ohio State should know that.
Ohio State does know that. And I think one of the things that will never go out of fashion for people in the athletic world is being disingenuous. Once you let people in the building, if you decide we're only going to have 1/6 the capacity, you're still going to have a ton of security dealing with a lot of people who either have had alcohol before the game or are going in to have alcohol, and you're not going to be able to tell a husband he cannot sit next to his wife. It won't. That's not going to happen. I mean, when you're letting in 20,000, you are letting in 100,000 because nobody's going to put out the kind of security that it takes to keep football crowds compliant to things that they're not used to. So I think the idea that, oh, well, we'll just let a few people in. Well, there's more than 20,000 season ticket holders. And how do you tell the season ticket holder who's been there since 1983, well, you can't get in this week or you can't get in this year? I mean, it's once you open the doors, you're opening them to everybody because it's not practical not to from a PR optic and political viewpoint. You either keep the doors closed to everybody or you open the doors and just hope that they don't trample you when they race in.
Well, and you know that there are at least 20,000 Ohio State alumni who think that they have already crossed that threshold of big enough donor and booster to where, of course, I'll be one of those 20,000 who are let in. And then wait until you find out that 50,000 people are giving more generously to the program than the 20,000 who thought that they'd be at the top of the heap. And now you got pissed off alumni and who can't get in, so on and so forth. It's just going to be, it's set up to be a mess. There is no doubt about it. So Larry Scott had an awful lot to say on our morning show today. On Monday, we had Bob Costas on. He was fantastic. He is Bob Costas. He is always an interesting guy. And we were, of course, talking with Bob about baseball's plan to return. And even if the plan has taken a little bit more form, even as, you know, unions and players are arguing with each other and players versus owners and so on and so forth, he just said, look, you want complicated, you got plenty of complicated waiting for you right here in any terms of baseball starting its year.
They have seemingly taken into account every possible consideration. But when you think of all the steps that will be necessary to pull this off, in theory, safely, and all the buy-in that would be necessary, roughly 100 people, counting players, coaches, medical staff, and front office people, roughly 100 people per team. So that's 3,000 people per 30 teams. You need complete buy-in. Nobody can decide to, if it's a road game, to leave their hotel room. Nobody can fail to take their own temperature each morning, which you're supposed to do. I mean, just read this thing. There's so much detail in it, I couldn't begin to list it now. And when you try to juggle that many balls, you know, not three or four or five, but dozens of balls juggling, it just makes sense that something's going to hit the ground.
Bob Costas, Monday afternoon here on 95.7 The Game. I saw this number this week, Ray, and again, it's hard to talk about baseball numbers because we don't know what number is real. We just don't. We don't have any transparency in their books. So the only number that we can use as fact is the number that they give us. So let's just use their number as fact. When they said that Commissioner Rob Manfred told CNN last week that owners could lose up to $4 billion if there were no baseball played at all this year. $4 billion. Okay, that's a lot of money. I mean, I think we can all agree on that. Even if you have very harsh standards for a lot of money, $4 billion should probably cross your threshold for you to agree. Yeah, that's a lot of money, especially for one person, right? But this is the crazy thing. Major League Baseball is not one person. It's not Mr. Baseball. It's not Mrs. Baseball. Major League Baseball has $4 billion that's basically whacked up 30 different ways. Baseball is 30 ultra-rich families bound together by the league. $4 billion, Ray, divided 30 ways is $133 million per team. Okay, $133 million is a lot of money. There's no doubt about that. But it's also the career earnings of Maglio Ordóñez, which feels like, you know, a cost that any major league franchise should be able to absorb. I mean, the cost of losing an entire season of Major League Baseball would cost the Giants what it cost to employ Matt Cain. Like, seriously, Matt Cain's contract would be worth, you lost it all because of a pandemic. Like, yeah, that's a lot of money. But that's also, like, nothing in the grand scheme of things, right? Like, Matt Cain's contract, it feels like a pandemic should cost you a lot more than that.
Well, it's not what they're losing. It's what they're not getting. And that's not just a semantic argument. It's, I mean, just to take the Giants, in the last 10 years, you know, with Charlie Johnson and before that, Harmon Burns in charge, what you've got is a team that's never lost a dime and that has raised its worth from $563 million in 2011, which is already 10 years into the new ballpark, to $3.1 billion. The least they've ever made in a year was $9 million, and last year they made $96 million. So, yeah, they can afford a bad year, but they don't want to.
They made $96 million last year with attendance falling apart?
That was the operating income. Now, ooh, that doesn't count amortization or other things, and I'm using Forbes as numbers, but basically that's the number they put. That's the number that Forbes put out, that it was their most profitable year ever.
Not so bad.
So in other words, you know, what we're talking about is not can they afford it, it's do they want to? And they don't want to. It's no more complicated than that. This is not a question of can. This is a question of, we'd rather not, so we're not going to.
At 4 o'clock, Thurl Bailey's joining us today to talk about the passing of great Utah Jazz coach, great former Chicago Bulls player, Jerry Sloan, who passed away this morning. That conversation with Thurl Bailey coming up at 4 o'clock. Late addition to today's guest list, Pat Forty, Sports Illustrated, is going to join us at 5 o'clock. We're very much looking forward to that. It's all brought to you by Fremont Bank, still open to serve the community that they love, with full-service banking and no compromises.
Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
A man with a 13-year-long NBA career and then several more seasons played over in Europe, Thurl Bailey, great North Carolina Wolfpack, right? He's joining us today at 4 o'clock. We're talking about the passing of Jerry Sloan. They're making guys like that no more. You're not going to see coaches like that ever fall off the tree again. There's no room for coaches like that probably in modern basketball anymore. He was a grinder. He was an old salt. And they don't make them like that no more. Thurl Bailey joining us today at 4 o'clock talking about the passing of Jerry Sloan today. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, just Damon and Ratto this afternoon. We've got this weekend, Ray, the golf.
That thing is once the doors get opened, that it's going to take a major active player or a whole team for this to stop. And all I've really wanted to know throughout this is, one, what would it take? And two, who would have the final call? Because I'm not sure that it would be Adam Silver. I still believe at that point, the owners, all of whom have a stake in this, are going to want to gather and say, we'll decide as a group what we're going to do about this. I mean, the Patrick Ewing stuff is sobering. It certainly is at Georgetown, where he's the head basketball coach. But,
yeah,
I mean, this is largely an eye-opener for people of our generation. I don't know that it's going to change a whole lot of minds, but it's a good kick in the face to remind you that the virus is not even close to being under control.
And, you know, if you think that there's a level of money, it's going to make everything okay. You probably thought Patrick had that level of money. I mean, look, Kevin Durant, right? Kevin Durant got it. But at least he was in gyms and around teams where this was happening. Who knows what brought this to Patrick Ewing or where Patrick Ewing went to get this, but it wasn't an NBA locker room and it wasn't an NBA game. Or maybe it was. I mean, who knows? We probably should have been tracking and tracing these things a whole lot harder than we have been. But oh well.
I know. I just think there's just going to be a series of surprises. And at some point, somebody will say, that's a surprise too far. And I'm not sure who, short of LeBron James, would make that happen in the NBA. Or Tom Brady in the NFL. Or maybe Patrick Mahomes in the NFL. Maybe it's more that. You know, screw with the games, and you risk a backlash of galactic proportions.
I wonder if it would take a commissioner actually coming down with it to catch like COVID-19 Jesus from a commissioner standpoint.
Nah, commissioners get ignored all the time. You could find a commissioner on the street. All he has to do is stand up and take all the grief that the owners don't want to take. I mean, it won't even take an owner. I mean, not even an owner catching it will matter. It's going to have to be somebody who brings in a ton of money. And in the NBA, you know, there are a couple of people like that, max. In the NFL, it would have to be somebody of such large reputation that it would scare the hell out of people out of going to games. I mean, it's going to take a whole lot.
Damon Bruce, Ray Ratto with you this afternoon, and welcome one and all to your 4 o'clock hour.